May it please the Court, Charles Gruber III representing the appellant Vincent Branson in this matter. Your Honors, with your permission, this is an intra-family dispute, so for purposes of the argument, I'm probably going to use their first names. Vincent Branson is the appellant, was the plaintiff in the court below. The other brothers are Robert, Albert, and David, and the sister is Teresa. So when I talk about individuals or representations, I'll be using their first name with the court's permission. Your Honor, I first want to speak, because of the chronological nature of where this matter went, on the grant of partial summary judgment, which was entered by Vice Chancellor Noble in this matter. We believe, quite frankly, that there was two errors of law in that summary judgment. First of all, that partial summary judgment. First of all, we have no objection and obviously agree with his findings that David, the one brother David, had an obligation or debt owed to Vincent in this situation, and basically based on that acknowledgement of debt. However, the court, in entering the order which was attached to our brief, basically indicated that, and I'll state it, petitioner's motion for partial summary judgment is granted insofar as the court finds that David Branson has a valid and enforceable obligation to pay Vincent Branson $85,000 due upon the sale of the property located at 10 North 4th Street, South Bethany Beach, Delaware. Your Honors, what we have objections to is, first of all, the court, in entering that order, said that it would be due upon the sale of the property in Bethany Beach. When they submitted the partial summary judgment motions on both sides, there was completely different opinions as to when the due date was for this particular obligation. Vincent basically provided an affidavit that said it was an indemnification and it was due basically upon the loss, which occurred in 2001, which is not contested by the parties. David said that it was due only when the beach house was sold. The court basically took this contested, disputed fact and ruled in favor of David by finding in its order, inexplicably, that it would be due at the time of the sale of the house. Thus, Vincent was never given that opportunity at trial to argue his position that it was an indemnification, it was due when the loss occurred in 2001. Compounding this, Your Honor, is that the court said in that order that this was an obligation, has a valid and enforceable obligation to pay Vincent Branson this $85,000. That, as I read it, is a debt. I believe it is an indemnification. There was a stock. He assured him that if they lost money on that stock, he would pay him back. That's a debt. In the court's decision after trial, Judge Vice Chancellor Noble completely transferred things and said it was a guarantee. And there was no finding of guarantee. There was a finding of a debt. Now, there's this clear distinction between one finding a guarantee and an indemnification or a debt situation. Just simply looking at Black's Law Dictionary, a guarantee, on the other hand, is a promise to pay to answer for the payments of some debt or performance of some duty in case or failure of another who is liable in the first instance. Indemnification is a duty to make good any loss, damage, or liability incurred by another. The judge finds in his order on partial summary judgment that this is a debt, therefore it's an indemnification. However, in its finding, in its decision after trial, it says this is a guarantee. Now, one of the impacts of that being a guarantee situation is that
a finding of fact?
That it was a guarantee?
Yes.
He indicates in the memorandum, Your Honor, that it was in fact a guarantee and not a debt situation. So I don't know. I think it's a decision. I don't think it's a finding of fact. I don't know how he can, Your Honor. It's a question of law. How can one who says, I will make you whole if you lose money, be a guarantor? I believe then that is a legal question. It's a question of law. If there's an obligation to pay because of your loss, I promise to do that. That is an indemnification.
How about what the parties intended? Does that come into play?
Well, that would have gone to the issue that the Vice Chancellor did not allow to be decided. He basically said there was two conflicting arguments.
Well, the reason I'm asking this is, what's our standard of review?
Well, it depends. If it's legal, it's de novo. If it's a legal issue, if it's a fact, if it's supported by the record, logical and orderly, then you must abide by the findings of the trial court.
So which is
it? I think it's a finding. I think it's a finding of fact. I think it is basically a position of law. It has to be, Your Honors, Justice, because it's not a guarantee. How can it be a guarantee? It's legal. It can only be an indemnification in that situation.
Could he just have, in effect, misspoken?
No, Your Honor. In fact, he didn't. If you read the decision, he basically talks about how I referenced the debt or something that was to that effect. But he then turns around and uses throughout the opinion, the memorandum opinion, that it was a guarantee. By being a guarantee, there is an argument that there's never any right to interest until some event occurs, and that would be the sale of the beach house. If it's an indemnification, the right to interest would have began when the loss occurred by Vincent Branson, which occurred back in 2001, in February 2001. By painting this as a guarantee, Vice Chancellor Noble basically said, requires that there's no interest. How can interest run on a guarantee? And that the dueness of that guarantee is not until the beach house is sold, which was a disputed fact that was never even permitted to go to trial. It was decided in the initial partial summary judgment order. In addition, the fact that they call it a guarantee or find a guarantee, a legal guarantee in this situation, throws into question whether Vincent would be entitled to an equitable lien based on this representation and promise that was made by his brother. Query, if one has an identification, an obligation to pay, I think this court under the Bronca v. Bronca standard, the equitable standard, can impose an equitable lien in that situation. You promised to pay. I have found, the court has found that it was due on the sale of the beach house. It seems perfectly square to then impose an equitable lien in that situation. If the court finds a guarantee, does that not prevent him from getting his sought remedy, which is an equitable lien on the premises until the premises are sold? Because this is the only security he has for this $85,000 debt. The next argument that was made, or I'd like to go to, is the specific performance that was raised against the three brothers in this situation. And I think it's very, very important to keep in mind the procedural aspects that occurred in this case. During the discovery process, a second amended complaint, the final complaint in this matter that went to trial, basically said that Mr. Vincent wanted specific performance against the interest of his brothers Albert and Robert because they had clearly made an agreement to sell their interest in the beach house to him, as so found by Vice Chancellor Noble in that situation. However, at that point in time, through discovery phase, David had taken the position that he was not aware of that situation and not acquiesced to that or agreed to that thing. Despite Teresa was kind of acting as the go-between, the negotiator between the family in this situation. And she represented to Vincent back in Christmas time of 2001 that all the brothers had agreed to sell their interest in the beach house to him. So when you're going to trial, you have a situation where both brothers have, in essence, there's an allegation that the two brothers, Robert and Albert, have to do specific performance on their oral agreements to sell their interest in the beach house. David has taken the position discovery is not aware of the situation. At the trial, David testified to two points. First, he said he would have been delighted to have had the properties be sold to Vincent because that would have dealt with this inter-family dispute situation. He also testified that he had received reports, or he had been informed by others of what was going on in this situation. With that, Vincent, who was then acting pro se, filed an amendment after the hearing, before decision, and before post-trial briefing, and amended his complaint to basically request that he also obtain specific performance on David's, because David has now indicated at trial that he was aware of what was going on with Teresa and was informed of what the deals were. So that's very important in this situation. What Vice Chancellor Noble ultimately decided, and it was not asserted by the defendants, it was not in their pretrial, it was not in anything that was raised, was this was an all-or-nothing proposition that Vincent wanted, and therefore, since he couldn't get the whole beach house, there's no agreement, even though two of the three brothers had clearly, and so found by Vice Chancellor Noble, had agreed to sell their interest in the property in this situation. The answer, we think, to that situation is that finding that it was an all-or-nothing situation is not supported by the record in this case. The two brothers had basically clearly said they would sell their interest in this property. Vincent had been told by his sister Teresa that David was willing and was going along with this deal as well. So we have this representation made to Vincent.
Wasn't there some condition expected of a written agreement or a more formal agreement?
Not at all. The way these individuals, Your Honor, if you look at the record in this situation, not at all. They had always done things verbally in transferring or agreeing to sell interest in property in that beach house.
But wasn't there testimony to that effect?
That what? That there was a written agreement?
That there was to be a written agreement before they were
I don't committed. Remember that, Your Honor. I'm being candid as to whether there was testimony there was to be a written agreement. I will, maybe I'm misunderstanding where you're coming from. After the agreement is reached, and maybe if I go a little farther, I'll understand better the question that was raised by you. After the verbal or oral agreement that's reached, which, again, Vice Chancellor finds is binding on two, but not on the third, Albert, who is living in the house, and he and Vincent are the only ones that really use the house in this situation, asked for two different extensions over, I think, a 12 or 13-month time frame because he wants to first qualify for social. First, he wants to stay there for a season. Then he wants to qualify for early Social Security, and then he wants to qualify for 65, age 65. At this point in time, in the beginning of 2003, when we've now had three extension requests made by Albert in the situation, or two extensions technically, and the request at the beginning that he agrees to sell his interest, but he wants to sell it after the beach season is through. Vincent then, at that point in time, begins to get worried as to whether they're ever going to have followed through with this situation. And Vice Chancellor Noble indicated there may very well have been a stall tactic going on by Albert at that situation. So Vincent, in January 3rd of 2003, sends a letter to the brothers and the sisters basically laying out what he understands to be the agreements between the parties and indicates to them, if there's any objection to this, let me know. He gets nothing from David. This is the one we're targeting about, we're concerned about. David says nothing in this situation. Teresa says, I'm no longer involved in this matter. I've renounced. You don't have to be involved with me in this situation anymore. Albert says, I believe it was Albert, I apologize, it was Robert, but one or the other one, it's not David, basically says, don't get a lawyer, let's talk about this. We got some issues. Now, whoever said that, Robert and Albert, and I apologize, I'm having a distant, but either one of them, whoever said that, the court found that both of them had already agreed to sell their interest in the situation. After eight more months, when no one said anything, then a contract was prepared by an attorney down in the Sussex area and then was submitted to the parties to confirm the agreement that had been previously reached. And at that point in time, David indicated that there was no agreement and he was not willing to do it. And the other brothers said, at that point in time, they were not willing to do it. So that's where basically, if you're talking about that they talked about an agreement, that's what I'm aware of in the record, Justice Richard. So we get to the situation as to where did the court find this all or nothing situation? The only point the court finds in their footnote 100, which is basically where they say, make this finding, he doesn't cite to anything in the transcript or anything in the record that basically says where he finds this all or nothing situation. But basically in another footnote on page 20 and footnote 91, he points to the fact that what Vincent said, he quotes this language, and what Vincent said in testimony was, quote, if in fact they honored their agreements, which happened after the appraisal came in, we would have had a meeting of the minds. The trial court basically said that shows that was not, it was an all or nothing situation. But think about what he said there. What he said was, if in fact they honored their agreements, he's saying that we had agreements. He said, we would have had a meeting of the minds. This did not connote that we did not have a meeting of the minds for a contract. Okay? It's that. In addition, what's very important is that the court did not point out that in that same language, right above it, the first question that was asked of him was, let me ask for some clarification with respect to the sale of the property. Are you contending in your lawsuit that there was an oral agreement by the family to sell the cottage to you? Answer, there was. So he had already indicated that it was his understanding that there was an oral agreement of the parties to sell him the beach house, all interest in the beach house. So we believe, or we submit to the court, that there is insufficient evidence in the record to support that finding that it was an all-or-nothing situation. And what's important, again, I repeat, there was nothing alleged like that in the pretrial. There was nothing alleged like that in the answer to the complaint. The only thing that was said was in the post-trial brief that was submitted by the appellees on page 9 in a footnote talking about a case. They have a sentence that says, plaintiff in this case has made it clear he never wanted partial ownership and has not requested in his prayers for relief. Any possible such claim, therefore, has been abandoned. Well, that's not true. He did put in his prayers for relief. He basically indicated in his complaint in that situation that he wanted specific performance against the two brothers, and then he amended after the trial, before the briefing, to include his additional brother, David, based on the principle of acquiescence or ratification. Excuse me. The court also said that he had not sufficiently sought an equitable lien in this situation, and therefore the court was not going to give that to him. Well, what the court ignored was the Bronca v. Bronca situation that basically says that one is can be entitled to an equitable lien based on the equities involved in the situation. So if the court finds down below that that David owes $85,000, and if the court finds below that is basically secured, in essence, secured by the beach house, or no, the court didn't say that. What the court said is you owe the $85,000 and you have to pay it when the beach house is sold. And our answer or our request to the court is, why would we not be entitled to a lien, an equitable lien on that property to protect our interest under the Bronca v. Bronca standard? Because we clearly have an obligation that was been found by the court, and the court has tied it to the beach house.
And you argued that to the vice chancellor?
I wasn't involved in that, Your Honor.
Was it argued at trial?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
It was a remedy sought in the complaint?
Equitable
lien was a
remedy
sought? Oh,
absolutely, Your Honor. The court, an equitable lien was sought in the situation. The vice chancellor rejected his right to an equitable lien, but it was, in fact, sought in this situation. And I think it goes to this guarantee situation versus an indemnification, which is the obligation to pay. There was additional trial court errors that warrant remanding portions of this back to the trial judge. And we pointed those out in the briefs, and I'm not going to get into those. I will point out just one that I think is pretty egregious: attorney fees. Mr. Vincent Branson requested attorney fees throughout the process, did it in his complaints, and did it in his pretrial order request and everything else like that. At the conclusion of the trial, David Ferry, who was representing him at that time, and this is when they're walking off, when I finished the completion of the evidence, basically said to the judge, Vice Chancellor Noble, that the attorneys have agreed to defer a request for attorney fees until after the court renders its decision after trial. And the judge said, Vice Chancellor Noble said, absolutely fine. Vice Chancellor Noble then writes his opinion and says that because Vincent has not pressed for his attorney fees, he is barred from getting them. This is complete contradiction to the deference that was agreed upon by the parties and approved by the court at the conclusion of the hearing of the trial. So this is clearly another situation where I just don't understand. If you say it's deferred and everybody agrees, and then you just say you can't get attorney fees.
You realize you're well into your rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely. I am Dave Weidman. I represent the appellees in this matter. And like Mr. Groover, I did not try the underlying case, but I have done my best to familiarize myself with the record so that I can address any issues that are before the court today. The first issue that I would like to address, if you don't have any questions right off the bat, is the standard of review that Justice Ridgely raised, because from our perspective, the appellant has it entirely wrong. The standard of review that is applicable here is deferential, because you are talking about a case before you that is entirely fact-driven. There is not one argument that the appellant has argued from our perspective that has addressed an issue of law, and I can go through each one of those to show you why that would be the case. So the standard of review before the court today from our perspective is not de novo at all. It would be a clearly erroneous standard. If there was any discretion that would be afforded to the trial court, it would be an abusive discretion standard, but not the de novo standard that the appellant has proffered to the court here. And I'll give you an example. The very first argument, the appellant wants this court to remand the matter to rule upon three contentions that the appellant is claimed to have properly presented and preserved, but that the trial court, did not rule on. And that is not the case at all. The trial court did address the three contentions that were outlined in the appellant's brief. And I attempted in my reply or my answering brief to go through each one of the contentions that were raised by the appellant at trial and show how the trial court addressed each one of those contentions. And one thing that I think is important here is that being a fact-driven case, the trial court had to sift through a variety of facts and funnel down those that were important. And that's exactly what this trial court did over a 34-page memorandum opinion. One matter that becomes crucial, as you all know, in these kinds of fact-driven cases are the credibility of the witnesses. And I don't think it's an overstatement to say that this trial judge found the appellant to be less than credible. In one case, in one part of the memorandum opinion, Vice Chancellor Noble said that this appellant undermined his own credibility by making an argument that the trial court had left open for him to make at the trial, which he didn't make. In another area, the trial judge said that the appellant had essentially thrown his siblings under the bus to try and make the facts comport to his version of the case. And then finally, and I think this was pretty strong language, the vice chancellor said that the appellant had stretched the truth. So the trial judge weighed all the testimony, he weighed all the facts, and he found that the appellant was not consistent in telling a credible story to this court, to that court. In the second argument that is raised, the appellant says this, that the trial court erred in failing to order specific performance against the defendants, Albert and Robert, based upon, and here's where the appellant betrays his argument that it's a question of law, based upon their oral agreements and admissions to sell their interests. Well, the trial court had to weigh that testimony at trial to determine the nature of those oral agreements. That is a fact-driven question. And the trial judge did that over a variety of pages in his memorandum opinion. In the third argument, the appellant says, should this court, the Supreme Court, agree with the trial court that David did not agree to sell his interest, then the trial court erred in failing to grant Vincent an equitable lien against David's share of the real estate. And if I can digress and address that issue for a moment, that's issue number three. The equitable lien issue, as I pointed out in my answering brief, was addressed. And it was addressed a number of times in the memorandum opinion. And essentially, if this court takes a step back, the court has to determine what did the trial court find in terms of an agreement. And so what is the equitable lien being asked to address? The terms of this agreement, according to the trial court, was that, and it was all verbal, was that Vincent was going to purchase some stock. And David said, if you purchase this stock, I will agree that you will not lose your investment. And according to the oral agreement, David said that you then lost your investment. I will pay you back when the beach house sells. That's the agreement that our client, admitted to making. The trial court weighed the opposing positions, as Mr. Groover noted. There was opposing testimony here. The trial court weighed that opposing testimony and specifically found that the agreement was that these two brothers had agreed that David would pay Vincent when the cottage sold. That's the agreement they struck.
And you would, that was only determined at trial? That wasn't a product of summary judgment?
That was a product of summary judgment.
Well, how does he weigh two different stories, summary judgment, and find one to be correct and one incorrect?
Because below, discovery had been completed, the briefing was submitted, and then he had, I believe there was an argument on that before the court, and this is what the judge said, the trial judge said, when he issued his decision. There is no obligation, at least on the record in front of me, for any payment to be made until the house in Bethany Beach is sold. And in fact, he said, I cannot adjudicate what would happen if there never is a sale. I cannot adjudicate what would happen if someone passes away, and we can't speculate to that.
Well, so there was no genuine issue of material fact about when the debt or the indemnification was owed?
That's correct, because David did
both
say...
Both agreed it would be only upon the sale of the house?
That's what David, my client, agreed to, and
no,
that's what the
that's
court found.
That's not my question. If it's proper for summary judgment, there has to be no genuine issue of material fact. Obviously, the timing of the debt is a material fact. There's a genuine issue about that if one party says it's owed as soon as I have a loss, and if the other one says, no, it's only to be paid back when the house is sold.
I understand.
How does a trial judge adjudicate that dispute in summary judgment?
This is what the judge found in his memorandum opinion. The judge said, as will be seen before the analysis, Vincent has once again stretched the truth to try to take something to which he's not entitled. Then he says, Vincent's argument is entirely predicated upon a mischaracterization of the guarantee. The court has already determined that the guarantee is a commercial obligation that David owes upon the sale of the cottage. He says, Vincent has insisted upon characterizing the guarantee as an interest-bearing loan. Not only is this characterization inconsistent with the court's decision and order, it is also at odds with Vincent's own testimony. So, Vincent agreed below that it was not a loan. And the trial judge cites to the record.
What he says, Vincent's own testimony, does he mean deposition testimony?
It looks like he's citing to a transcript at page 69 through 70. I'm assuming that's the trial testimony, and that's what he addressed.
Opinion is this? You were reading from an opinion post-trial?
I was just reading from the memorandum opinion.
Previously, on the summary judgment?
No, I was just reading from the memorandum opinion that he issued in writing.
Post-trial?
Post-trial. Previously, and that's a good question, previously I was reading from the transcript when he issued the bench order on the partial summary judgment.
I'm simply trying to get it straight. When the trial judge made this determination that the guarantee was subject to sale of the house, did he make it as partial summary judgment, or is it a conclusion he reached for the first time at the conclusion of a full-blown trial?
I believe it was both, and I'll tell you why. He weighed the evidence that was before him in the partial summary judgment motion, but then what he says in his memorandum opinion post-trial is, regardless of whether Vincent's account matches David's, Vincent conceded at trial that the $85,000 was not given as a loan. So I believe the issue came up at trial as well, and he spent about four pages discussing the timing of that $85,000. In fact, on page 33 of the memorandum opinion, he says, in other words, he, Vincent, presents no argument that the cottage was ever sold for purposes of triggering the guarantee. So Vincent was aware that the judge had made that ruling, and it came up again at trial regarding the timing of that $85,000 payment in the context, I believe, of the equitable lien theory. But regardless, again, you're talking about a discrepancy in the versions of the stories, which is a disputed fact issue. And the judge weighed the disputed facts, and the judge found that David's credibility was paramount in this case.
So is it your position then that, let's assume that the vice chancellor erred in ruling in summary fashion on this issue, that error was cured by a factual finding at trial?
That would be my position. And then if we take that further and we assume that the judge erred on that, in granting partial summary judgment, then this court would be faced with, well, what does it do with that error? And if the court sends it back and remands it, you have a 400-page transcript that did address those issues, and the court found that David had agreed, because he admitted it, that he agreed that the $85,000 was due upon the sale of the cottage.
All right. Let's assume that there's some mystery about the various characterizations of an obligation. What do you make of this debt versus indemnification versus guarantee scenario that we heard about?
Without sounding flip, Chief Justice, I don't make a whole lot of it, and I'm going to tell you why again. And that's because you had two opposing stories, and David conceded that he owed the $85,000. He conceded that he owed the $85,000 because his brother lost his investment on the sale of stock. Vincent's position shifted, and that's where the Vice Chancellor said that his credibility, he impeached his own credibility, because he said it was a loan without any evidence whatsoever that it was ever a loan. And Vincent's...
Let's come back while we're talking about credibility to the record support for this all or nothing conclusion that the Vice Chancellor reached. There are a couple of ways to get there. There may be more. One would be that Vincent says to each brother, I'll buy your share if everybody sells, and then the agreement is contingent on all three, including David, selling. And the other would be that each brother would say, I'll sell if everybody else sells. But if either of those two scenarios took place, then you'd have something that was all or nothing. As I understand the appellant's position, he agreed to buy from two of the brothers, no matter what. That's his position. And that the fact that David decided not to sell had nothing to do with the two agreements he had reached. Now, somewhere along the line, the Vice Chancellor said, no, it was all or nothing. What's the record basis for that?
The record basis is that, and I believe the Vice Chancellor, in reviewing the record, amply and clearly stated why he found that. Because the appellant's theory, Justice Holland, throughout the entire case was that it was all or nothing. It was, I had an agreement to buy this cottage from all my siblings. The proposition was, I'm buying all of it, 100% of it.
And that's based on the sister's recitation of what she thought David had agreed to do. Once the sister said, David's on board also, is that the agreement that he was trying to enforce?
I believe that that's the agreement that the appellant thought he was under. But to support the idea that it was all or nothing, the record is void of any specific terms that he struck as part of a bargain with any one of his individual brothers. There is no price discussion. There is no discussion on when the sale would take place. There was no discussion as how he was going to buy any individual interest.
So this relates to the written agreement that was eventually circulated, that from your perspective, these were all negotiations subject to being reduced to a written agreement.
Absolutely. That's what the record shows, and that's what the trial judge found. 100% along the way in this journey, the appellant's position was consistently, I have an agreement to buy all the cottage. He even said that. The trial judge even cited that. He knew he had to get David because he said, I need 100% of the cottage. At one point in his testimony, he said, it doesn't do me any good not to have David. All that testimony clearly indicates the one of the former two versions that you outlined, Justice Holland. There is no support for this new theory that, well, the trial judge didn't grant me 100%, so now I'm going to say that the trial judge erred because he should have at least given me the other two. He never, ever presented that argument to the trial judge at any point. and there are never any terms that are outlined in any part of this record to support that argument.
So there was never an agreement on price?
Of the individual pieces.
What do you mean by that?
Meaning, if he was going to buy Albert's share, I agree to buy your share as a tenant in common for $100,000.
Okay, well, his 2007 letter said, I'll buy the cottage for X amount of dollars, asking that everyone confirm that they understood that to be the deal.
That's what his 2007.
And he never heard from David.
That's right. And think about, Justice Steele, the timing of that. 4 years after the, 5 years after the discussions were initiated, he sends this letter. I mean, by then, as the record shows, the brothers had moved on. They didn't have any interest in selling their share at that point, individually or otherwise. So when I say that there was no price term, it was all or nothing. You make a great point, because at that point in time, I think it was $345,000. Which shows that the appellant thought that it was all or nothing. And that's where the vice chancellor came up with that, because he being the vice chancellor, was never confronted with any other argument.
So you're saying the record shows there was only one price offered for the entire cottage, and to the extent any of the brothers were going to agree to that, they recognized they would get their legal pro rata share of the one price.
That's right. That's what the record shows. Because in reviewing the record, I could not find, maybe this court found, I could not find any discussions anywhere in this record for the appellant to purchase Albert's share individually or to purchase Robert's share individually. Basically, what he was doing was almost canvassing his siblings and saying, I want to own 100% of this beach cottage. Are you willing to sell? Which is a scenario that you outlined.
Are you willing to sell for this aggregate price?
Exactly. And that's the theory that he pursued the entire case, and that's the claim that he presented, and that's what the trial court found. In fact, the trial court was deciding his claim, which, again, required a specific and detailed sifting of all the facts in this case, a weighing of the testimony, which is not a de novo standard.
Well, assuming all of that's true from your perspective, and why doesn't it make sense to impose a lien on the property to maintain the agreed-to priority?
In a perfect world, it might, but here's the problem with doing it in this particular case. As my answering brief attempted to outline, this equitable lien theory kept shifting. So the question is, what equitable lien do you impose? And if you impose an equitable lien, what does it accomplish? Because the trial court found that these two brothers had a specific agreement. In essence, as I said, he has an equitable lien.
I'm not sure I understand what you just said. We know that David promised to pay Vincent the loss he took in buying the stock. What was disputed was whether it was owed immediately or whether it was a guarantee that it would be paid out of David's proceeds from the sale of the cottage, and that it would therefore never be paid until the cottage was actually sold. But there was never a dispute about what was owed or why.
That's true.
So why isn't an equitable lien the logical remedy?
Then the question becomes, what is the equitable lien over? I think the appellant's position is the equitable lien is over David's share of the cottage. But he already has an equitable lien over David's share of the cottage, because when it sells, which is what the vice chancellor found is the trigger, when it sells, he gets his $85,000.
But that assumes that the cottage remains unencumbered. If there are liens put on the property in the interim, then when the cottage is sold, there may be no money to pay the $85,000. So that's the purpose of my question. While the cottage is unencumbered, why isn't it equitable to put a lien on the cottage's equity while the equity still exists?
All I can say, I don't know why. I don't know why the vice chancellor decided that way. I'm going to answer your question by saying I believe that the vice chancellor found that David got everything he was entitled to from the estate and from the agreement that he struck with his brother.
Well, if you don't know why and can't explain why he did not impose an equitable lien, which ordinarily would be imposed, correct, how can we find no abuse of discretion?
Because if he weighed the equities, and I believe he did, then he decided that it wasn't a fair thing to do.
Well, remind us, what's the status of the title? As I understood the record at one time, the siblings were all on the title. There were all of these agreements for relinquishing their interest in the title, but none of them were ever reflected in a recorded deed. Then there was some quick claim deeds exchanged. And so if I looked at the title today, I know that Vincent's name is apparently still on the title. What other names are on the title?
I can answer that. It is the four siblings.
Everyone except the sister.
Everyone except the sister. Vincent, Albert, Robert, and David.
And your position is that notwithstanding that's the status of the legal title, Vincent is off because he agreed to be off. I understand there's a later dispute about that. So your position is only the three other brothers have a legal interest?
Yes, and that is what the court below found in very specific percentages, because the brothers presented that evidence into court as to how they arrived at those specific percentages.
So the three of them are holding it as tenants in common?
Yes, but for the fact that record title shows that Vincent is still a part of that property.
No, I understand that. So, but going back to our questions about an equitable lien, if an equitable lien was imposed, it would encumber David's undivided interest as a tenant in common.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. I see that I'm out of time, and I've gone way over. I'm sorry. I was trying to answer your questions.
You're only over because we kept asking questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I recognize that I only have a minute, so I'll be very, very brief.
In your minute, tell us if there was ever an offer for a specific share for any of the brothers, or does the record show there was only one offer for the entire cottage?
What the record shows is that Teresa came to Vincent or to the brothers and said, why don't you sell the beach house to your brother, your interest in the beach house to your brother, and Albert and Robert said yes, and Teresa and she said, how about David? And Robert or Albert said he will go along with that situation.
My
so
question
that was communicated. I'm sorry.
My question must not be clear. Was there ever an individual brother price discussed, or was the record only one price for the cottage? Everybody agrees to sell for the one price.
The only thing on the record was that the property would be sold totally for the $345,000 appraised value that was determined by the estate appraisal. But at that time, what the assumption was, Vincent had been told, that all three brothers had agreed in that situation. In addition, if you remember, if you look at the record, Robert did a breakdown of what the percentages of each brother had based on the monies that were received by Vincent. So we knew very clearly what the percentage of each brother would have received for their interest in that situation. But there was never discussions of you'll get X dollars, because it was told to Vincent that all had agreed. And then you have the percentages being divvied up by Robert afterwards in the 20%. David ended up with 22%. Everybody's percentages was laid out by Robert as accepted by the executor in this situation.
But the real question is there's nothing in the record that says, Vincent says, okay, Robert, we've all agreed your interest is 32%. I will pay you 32% of $345,000 for your interest, no matter what anyone else does.
The first part of it is there's $345,000, and there was in the record that they agreed on what their interest, the brothers' interests were.
Right.
But they did not say, okay, therefore, yours is allocated, 67% of that. You will get this. I agree to pay you that. There's not that in the record.
Okay.
Chief Justice. There was talk about 4 years after, that this letter was in 2007 and 4 years later, and you can't expect that to be accepted. The problem with that is the letter was in 2003, and the delay was because Albert wanted to continue to stay in the house until he received Social Security. So Albert continued to request extensions with the approvals of Robert and presumed approval of David in that situation. So there's nothing they could hold on the argument that says we were trying to hold it back for 7 years until 2007. We were ready to go. We had financing. We sent the letter. We're ready to go. Albert says, I'd like to stay there until I reach full Social Security situations.
Thank you, Mr. Gruber.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.